This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do humans have a monopoly on dreaming? The author of a new book looks at the mysterious world of animal dreams and what that tells us about how their minds work. Now, a Marquette University Law School poll published this past Wednesday shows that 69% of Wisconsin voters support the legalization of marijuana. Historically, Republican voters have leaned against legalization, but for the first time, two Marquette polls this year find that just over half of Republican voters are in favor of legalizing cannabis. Marijuana remains illegal in the state with Republican opposition in the state legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you had the option, would you vote to legalize marijuana? If so, medicinally only or also recreationally? Are you one of those Republicans who supports marijuana legalization? Has your mind, whatever your party you think of yourself as a part of, has your mind changed on this issue in recent years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Mikos is a law professor at Vanderbilt University focusing on federalism and drug law, including marijuana legalization. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we've seen over time this gradual increase in support for marijuana legalization in Wisconsin, including among Republican voters. Now, this year, two polls say 51% of Republicans support it. In this most recent one, is 51% support, 39% opposed, the rest undecided. Are we an outlier, or are we seeing this trend with Republicans around the country?
I think we've seen this everywhere, including in both states that have already legalized, but also in states that have not, that there's growing support for legalization really in all segments of society, with maybe only a few holdouts out there. So it's not surprising to me to see this in Wisconsin.
We've seen a trickle of states and then a rush of states approving marijuana legalization recreationally, I think now in 19 states, medicinally, I think another 19 states. What have things been like this year? Are we seeing more of that trend in action?
Yes. So you see sort of a steady trickle of states, especially turning their attention to legalization for recreational purposes or adult use, because we have so many states already, as you mentioned, about 38 states that have legalized for medical use. Really, in most places, the next question is about recreational use. But we're seeing a steady trickle of states, some doing it through state legislatures, but more commonly, it's been done through ballot initiatives. And we'll see several of those probably pop up this fall or in the coming years in other states.
Now, Wisconsin is a state without a binding ballot initiative process, except for a constitutional amendment, which would still have to start in the legislature. What has the situation been in states like Wisconsin with Republican-controlled legislatures without that binding statewide referendum process?
Yeah, it's very different than in other states that do have the referenda process. The referenda obviously is a way to sort of sidestep your state legislature. And almost by their very nature, state legislatures are more conservative than the population at large. They tend to do things a little bit more slowly. And that's the whole purpose behind many of these ballot referenda processes. But in states that don't have that, you see a lot less movement in a lot of different reform areas, but especially marijuana law. Many of the states, those 38 states that I mentioned that have legalized medical use of marijuana, they include some very conservative states like Oklahoma, Utah, just as two examples, Florida and Ohio as well. But those states have ballot initiatives. They have an alternative process for changing the law. And that's why I think it got a hold in those states, but maybe hasn't in other states like Wisconsin and Tennessee that may have similar politics.
Talking to law professor Rob Mikos from Vanderbilt University, looking at marijuana legalization. Again, a Marquette University Law School poll shows a substantial majority support legalization in the state, including a narrow majority of Republicans. You can tell us what you think about the idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello. Mark, are you there?
I'm here.
Yep, you're on the air. Go for it.
So I work in hospice care, and I go into people's homes, and I visit cute little grandmas and grandpas all the time. And occasionally I look in their magazine rack, and they have those fancy cookies and candies and gummies. I don't know where they get them. I don't ask. It's none of my business. It takes their pain away. And they swear by it. And by golly, if that grandma can eat that little cookie and her pain goes away and she doesn't have to take opioids, why not? I say go for it.
Mark, thanks for that call and sharing your experience there. Rob, obviously those, I guess, are technically smuggled if you see this in Wisconsin. But are we hearing more attitudes like that as, if this is an alternative to pain management, an alternative to something like opioids with all the problems that they entail, are you hearing that argument more and more?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Mark's anecdote kind of nicely conveys that it's even easier to sell medical legalization than it is sort of broader legalization for all adults. So even though those numbers you cited before from the latest Marquette poll, the 69% of Wisconsin voters overall favor legalization for adult use, I would hazard that a much even higher percentage than that, maybe 90%, would support for medical use. And in large part, it's because lots of people know a grandparent or another relative, a parent maybe, who was sick and maybe tried the drug and thought that it benefited them, maybe improved their appetite when they were seriously ill, maybe lessened their pain when they're at end of life. And that creates a very powerful story. It's a very powerful selling point for medical legalization in a lot of states. So in most states, they lead with medical legalization in large part because it's an easier sell. For reasons like that, and then later broadened to all adult use. But I think that's part of the sales pitch for medical legalization.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob, I've talked to you in the past about how states implement marijuana laws. I think in a lot of states, lawmakers might be taking a wait-and-see approach, see how the early adopters have crafted their laws. What are some of the biggest, I guess, lessons learned from the earliest states to go full on recreational marijuana legalization?
Well, I think one thing is the sky doesn't fall when you do this. I think that's clear. The world hasn't ended in Colorado and California and Nevada and Massachusetts and all the other places, Michigan next door to Wisconsin, Illinois. The sky doesn't fall. And that was a big concern maybe in the early days when Colorado and Washington State were the first to do this back in 2012. But we now have 10 years of experience from those states that have legalized it for adult use, and more than a quarter century of experience in states that have legalized it for medical use. So I think all the worries that may have been sparked at the outset, all the pessimism that may have been out there, has been largely dispelled. So that's one big takeaway from these states. The other takeaway is more an implementation story. And it's really that, this actually turns out to be fairly complicated, how you pull this off. There are lots of choices that states need to make. It's not like flipping on or off a light switch, ending prohibition. There are things like, how are you going to license suppliers? Are you going to let people use this in public, in bars or other establishments like that, lounges and so on? Are you going to protect people from employment sanctions, from being fired on the job if they use marijuana off the job. So it's actually a pretty complicated reform to implement. But those are the sort of questions that states need to work out, usually after kind of taking the plunge. But I think the big message is what we know now is the world doesn't get markedly worse if you do this. And there is some upside to it as well.
We're talking to Rob Mikos, a Vanderbilt University law professor, looking at changing public opinion surrounding marijuana legalization, steps taken in other states, Wisconsin not among those states legalizing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is it time to legalize marijuana in Wisconsin? If so, full recreational, medicinal? What are some of the finer points you'd like to see tackled if we did this? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Rob Mikos, Vanderbilt University Law School professor, studying marijuana legalization in addition to other drug laws, with us to talk about a new poll published last week that shows the majority of people in Wisconsin would vote to legalize marijuana, including a narrow majority of Republican voters. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Eau Claire. Mary, hello.
Hi. Say, there's something I always wonder. I'm for legalization in general, but what I wonder about Wisconsin, and especially those Republicans there, don't they want to make money? Aren't they for the farmers? Didn't we used to be one of the greatest hemp producers when hemp rope was the only thing you could take to see? And have you ever seen what they do with hemp cloth lately?
Gotcha, Mary. Thanks for the call. Rob, actually, hemp production is legal in Wisconsin. There's, you know, you have to be inspected. It has to be a very low THC percentage of production, partly for CBD oil, some for the fiber products she was talking about. She also mentioned, Rob, the financial benefits. Are we seeing, the supporters of legalization talk that up a lot. Are we seeing huge financial benefits for states that have legalized?
Well, you're seeing a couple of different financial benefits. One are the tax revenues that this generates. So in some states like Colorado that have an established industry, they'll charge a tax on the sale of marijuana, mostly for adult use. It's roughly about 25 to 35% of the retail price of the drug. It varies from state to state. But some states, including Colorado, generate more than $1 billion a year in marijuana tax revenues. And that's actually eclipsing in some states the amount of revenue that they generate from taxes on the sale of alcohol. So it is generating some money, and states will invest that in different ways, turn around, put it into the general fund, invest in schools, that sort of thing. The other thing it's done is in some states it's generated jobs. You know, it's a new industry that you have people involved in cultivation and the processing of the drug and the retail side, of course, in testing, all the back office operations and so on. And I don't know how much credibility to give some of these reports, but there have been some reports that try to sum up the number of jobs that have been generated in this new industry and suggest that it's about 300,000 in those states that have legalized marijuana for medical and or adult use. There are about 300,000 new jobs that exist in these industries or in associated industries.
Thanks for that call, Mary, at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now from Toma. Tom, what did you want to bring up?
Hey, I'm very familiar with the industry, both here newly and very familiar with Colorado area. Been in it for quite a while. I have seen the way the recent, I don't know what to call it, a piece of legislation to get it passed that the Republicans tried to push through or not push through, but bring through. And my only concern was about, as we all know, we're rural patients, we're rural people here in Wisconsin. It only allows for you to go to, let's say, concentrate versions of sodas and edibles. How does that leave, you know, the average, you know, person that needs it in rural northern Wisconsin who can't travel that far? They're unable to grow it themselves. So, yeah, I would be very curious and wary on how the future laws are written. Wonder if he has any ideas on how that might be coming into play.
Thanks for the call, Rob. I think Tom referring to some legislation that was in the legislature, didn't get advanced beyond any sort of committees or hearings or anything like that. But Tom worried, Rob, about kind of, I guess, half measures that don't really do much for the marijuana industry.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple things from Tom's comment. You can always look to other states for models of how to pull this off. You know, anything you might envision has probably been tried somewhere before. So, for example, Tom's concerned about people in rural areas maybe not having easy access to marijuana products once the state legalizes the drug for medical or other purposes. One way other states have tried to handle something like that is to say, if you live more than, say, 25 or 50 miles away from a dispensary, then and only then you're allowed to grow your own. So that's one solution some states have come up with to try to expand access in more rural areas that might be far away from the retail dispensaries that you would see in the bigger cities. The other issue we've seen in some states is some states have kind of gone very slowly in legalizing something like medical marijuana. They don't legalize every product that you see in California or Colorado. They might legalize edibles, but not smokable product, or they might only legalize some oils or other concentrates, but not other things. And I think one general trend we've seen from those states is that even when they start small, I think they realize pretty soon that, again, the world doesn't end when you do this, and you see some openness to gradually expanding those bills. So you might start with something that's fairly modest, but 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road, you might see the legislature in a place like Wisconsin loosening some of those restrictions once they figure out that they didn't end the world when they legalized, you know, a very narrow form of marijuana for medical or other purposes.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We're talking to Rob Mikos, Vanderbilt University law professor. We're talking about marijuana legalization, growth and support for it in recent surveys of Wisconsin voters, still illegal here. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sandra is with us in Friendship. Sandra, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up that I'm for legalization, but it's very important that we get medical marijuana legalized for cancer patients and so many others.
Sandra, thanks for that call. I want to follow up with another caller right away. I think on this topic, Lisa is with us in Winters. Lisa, hello.
Hello. The reason I'm calling is because I've had 4 family members go through cancer treatments. One died, he had bone cancer. My brother had 5 different primary cancers. He moved to Michigan so that he could get medical marijuana. He is cured. My other sister, I used to drive to Michigan to bring back medical marijuana for her. She's fine. And now I have another sister who's got brain cancer and bone cancer. She's not going to make it. But I literally drive to Michigan once a week to get her edibles because the girl is 100 pounds, or was 100 pounds, and now is 63 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's the only thing I can do to help her gain weight.
Lisa, I'm so sorry your family's going through all of this. But again, it speaks to both those callers, Rob, speaks to the support for medical marijuana in particular.
Yes, and it also kind of demonstrates that prohibition doesn't necessarily stop people from using this. from getting access to it. So it begs the question, why continue that? Especially vis-a-vis people who are trying to use it for medical reasons. It doesn't seem to stop that particular use. Does make it more difficult, may force some people to leave the state, or may force some people to rely on relatives to smuggle it in and put themselves in legal jeopardy. But it just illustrates that there are a lot of people with similar stories out there that would really support, especially medical legalization. It's such a poignant story.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. Best to your family. Time for one more caller. Mona is with us in Madison. Mona, hello.
Hello. Hi. Taking my call. My comment is I am all in favor of legalizing marijuana for everybody. However, I would really feel a lot more comfortable purchasing it for my own use if it was available from the pharmacist like Sudafed. So it's monitored and it's controlled somehow. There's some kind of quality control with it.
Interesting.
You need a prescription, you can just go ask for it. But, you know,
I gotcha, Mona. We don't have too much time left. But, Rob, how have states handled, I guess, quality control of available marijuana where it's legal?
Yeah, every state where it's legal has a thick body of regulations specifying, you know, how the drug is supposed to be processed, how it's supposed to be packaged. They require testing and then labeling of the product. So you know what you're getting, you know what different mix of cannabinoids are in there, how much THC, how much CBD, and so on. And that's very important. And you look at places like Colorado, they'll have 100 pages of regulations designed really to protect the consumer and inform the consumer so that they're not buying this on the black market, so that they know what they're getting, so that what they get is not laced with, you know, something else like fentanyl or maybe has a pesticide in it.
Thanks for that call. And Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Robert Mikos, law professor at Vanderbilt University, focusing on federalism and drug law, including marijuana legalization. Talked to him after another Marquette University Law School poll came out showing support for legalization here in the state. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, there's a $1 billion black market in timber. Follow that story with the author of the new book, Tree Thieves, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes controversy comes up in unexpected places, like on our Food Friday conversation a couple weeks back. I talked to the author of a zucchini cookbook. I brought up the idea of making relish out of zucchini. She said, no, don't do it. I said it's a good way to use up those overgrown zucchini. She says they should be thrown in the compost pile. Okay, we agreed to disagree and moved on. But last night, I put my side of the argument into action. One of the zucchinis in my garden got big unexpectedly fast. So I made a batch of this zucchini relish recipe. You might have heard me talk about it on the show. Zucchini, bell peppers, onion, plus vinegar and stuff. Broke out the food processor. Zucchini, etc. Ended up making almost 3 pints, and it's really good, no matter what cookbook authors say. You can find a link to the recipe I use at WPR.org. Just search for zucchini extravaganza. If you have excess zucchini, you'll be glad you did. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, extreme heat now kills more Americans than hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes. You'll hear how cities, states, and the federal government are responding to reduce the number of lives lost to heat. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, many pet owners have seen their dog or cat asleep on the couch or the ground and watched them kick their legs or fidget in their sleep. It looks like our pets are dreaming. They can't tell us what they were dreaming about, but it seems like they're experiencing something imaginary while asleep. So if our pets can dream, does that mean all animals can dream? If animals can dream, what does that tell us about how their minds work? In his new book, our next guest explores the neurological and philosophical sides of animals, their brains, and what happens when they sleep. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that animals dream? Have you ever seen one of your pets and you thought maybe it was having a dream? What do you think they dream about? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Peña Guzman is an associate professor of humanities at San Francisco State University. His new book is called When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Before we get into some of the science and philosophy behind whether animals dream, you're asking the question for a couple reasons. A, it's super interesting. B, the answer to these questions you write will influence how we treat the rest of the animals that we share this planet with. Can you talk about what you're hoping comes out of that?
Yeah, this is something that I talk in the book, especially towards the end, that for a long time we have known that what we know about the minds of other animals ends up having repercussions that go far beyond simply that curiosity that we might have about what goes on in their minds, either when they're awake or when they're asleep. There are also legal, political, and moral implications. And in the book, I talk about specifically the connection between the minds of other animals, their consciousness, and then the moral obligations that we might have toward them once we realize that they are indeed conscious, that they are sentient beings who are agents in the world.
You review the science behind animals and sleep and dreaming. There's not a ton of it in some ways, and there was a big switch in the 19th century, in the 1800s. A lot of people who did research said, of course, yeah, animals dream. And then there was a turn against that idea. What led to that?
Yeah, if you look at the writings of very famous 19th century naturalists, I mean, here we're talking about people like Charles Darwin, what you find is that most of them were very open to the idea that dreaming is a parallel that we find between human and non-human animals. If you look at animals like dogs and cats, but even at more distant creatures, distant from us from an evolutionary perspective, that is, you find these recreations or reconstructions of the world in the middle of the sleep cycle. And so in the 19th century, this was not a radical idea. It was not taboo. In fact, it was thought to be a pretty natural consequence of the, at that time, rising evolutionary framework. So once you accept that, of course, all the diversity of animal forms that we observe in nature is the result of evolution, then of course you expect to see a lot of continuity at the level of behavioral capacities, mental capacities, and so on. And so there's a lot of writing about animals having things like dreams, animals having concepts, animals having emotions. And unfortunately, all of this changes in the early 20th century. And the story that I tell in the book places psychology as a new science at the end of the 19th century front and center, because in the early 20th century, psychology did somewhat of a shift, or it pivoted away from a certain way of doing psychology to a new way of doing psychology. And this is what is known as behaviorism. Behaviorism, in very simple terms, is a style of thinking in psychology that basically says, look, we are not going to worry about mental phenomena. We're only going to focus on behavior. Why? Well, because behavior obviously is much more easily controlled. It is much more easily elicited, and it is measurable in a way that purely mental events are not. So for instance, you can measure how far a dog walks. You can measure how many times they wag their tail, but you cannot really measure things like their thoughts, their emotions, and obviously their dreams. And so for a long time, for most of the first half of the 20th century, which is what I call the silent century in the book, there is this deafening silence about the minds of other animals. And I think this was a major mistake in the history of science. And thankfully, in the last few decades, this has been changing. I would say it's been changing now for about 3, 4, maybe even 5 decades. But the legacy of behaviorism is still very much with us. And it's something that we still have to actively resist in the natural sciences and especially in the animal sciences.
We're talking to David Peña Guzman. His new book is called When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever watched your pet sleeping and thought, hey, I think they're having a dream now based on their behavior? 800-642-1234. I want to check out a couple of the studies you share in the book. Now we have brain imaging technology. You share the story of, I think it was a bird. It was a kind of finch that maybe was doing some musical rehearsals in its sleep. Can you share that story?
Yeah, that's right. These are zebra finches, which are birds native to Australia. And one of the things that we know about these birds is that they sing a song and their song is not innate. In other words, it's not as if a little zebra finch, you know, comes out of the egg already having that, all the information for that song somehow preloaded into their brain or their nervous system. It's not in the genes from the moment of birth. And so that means that every single zebra finch has a challenge, which is how am I going to memorize this really complicated melody that I need in order to be a zebra finch? And we know that they have to practice because they learn it from their parents and their siblings, and they usually have to practice. So they listen to others singing the song, and then they set to trying to internalize it on their own. So they practice during the day. And I found research showing that at night, they also practice their song. And when I say at night, I don't just mean when the sun goes down. I mean when the zebras, when the zebra finches fall asleep. And so if you look at the zebra finch brain in the middle of the sleep cycle, especially as these animals are transitioning into what is known as REM sleep, which is typically when animals have dreams, statistically speaking, the areas of the brain that start lighting up are precisely the same that light up during the waking state when these animals are rehearsing their song. And so we know that these animals have these auditory, magnificent, beautiful dreams. And it might be that their dreams are even playing a central function of memory consolidation, whereby by dreaming about their song, these animals are memorizing the song that they need in order to succeed and flourish as finches during the day.
That's just one of the examples you give in the book of different species that seem to be having some kind of dreams. But it brings up an important point. There, a finch's dream might be very auditory. A dog's dream might be very smell-oriented. What we think of as dreaming might not apply. It might look very different, feel very different to a different animal having those dreams.
That's correct. And one important point, one takeaway from my research is that we need to be extremely careful about being anthropocentric, which is a bit of a mouthful. it just comes from the root anthropos, a Greek term meaning human, and centric. And so we need to not center humans in our thinking about and in our definition of certain phenomena such as dreams. And so, of course, in the case of humans, the vast majority of human dreams tend to be visual because we are, by large, a visual species. But when you shift the focus away from humans to other animals, then you have to be open to the fact that those dreams will follow the sensory capacities of those animals rather than the expectations that we might project based on our particular case, right? A dog is never going to dream a human dream. A zebra finch is not going to dream a dog dream either. And so paying attention to those differences is really important, but it also adds a major level of difficulty for us thinking about the dreams of other animals, especially when they are, when they become less and less similar to ours.
We're talking to philosophy professor David Peña Guzman about his new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered examples where you've seen an animal, maybe your pet, and you think it's having a dream, probably based on what it's doing while it's sleeping. Have you ever thought about what it means for an animal to dream or have imagination? What questions do you have about animal consciousness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with David Peña Guzman, philosophy professor at San Francisco State University, author of the book When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think animals dream? Do you think your pet does? What questions do you have about animal dreams and animal consciousness? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Shaquan is with us in Beloit. Shaquan, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
It's so crazy because, like, literally yesterday I was looking up the subject, and it's so intriguing. That's why I love NPR. But basically, it was like it extends to all species, even insects and such, but they kind of, like, eliminate it because they correlated with REM sleep. But it's more in, like, their baby phase, as they put it. Like, all species dream in their baby phase more. But I'm not sure. I wonder if that did extend to insects and stuff as well.
Interesting question. And I just saw on NPR.org, actually, something about spiders maybe having a REM, or rapid eye movement cycle. How about next door in the insect world, David? Do we know anything about what's going on there?
Yeah, we do know some things. I think it was around 2014, 2015, that some research started coming out about honeybees. Showing that they show a lot of signs of what we would call dreaming. Of course, this becomes extremely thought-provoking because insects have historically suffered from the terrible fate of being seen as the simplest of animals, at least like the large-scale animals that we interact with on a daily basis. So often people assume that because they have so-called simple nervous systems, that they couldn't possibly perform certain mental or cognitive operations that we deem impressive, like dreaming. And yet the research suggests that we might have to extend it to insects and also to arthropods like spiders. This research on jumping spiders that you just mentioned just came out about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. I mean, my book came out in July, in the summer, so it's in many ways hot off the press. And already there is new research that I didn't have at the time that I was writing it. So brand new research showing that jumping spiders, which are a particularly visual kind of spider that relies on vision much more than sensation, than sensing vibrations on the ground, that when they fall asleep, they also show, they display the same kind of REM movements, rapid eye movements, that in human beings, since the 1950s, we have treated as very clear indicators of dreaming. So, you know, the small critters of the world are now claiming their place in the community of dreamers. And I think that's very exciting.
Shaquan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David, you write that, you know, whether we're talking about zebra finches or rats showing signs that they're thinking about moving around in mazes while they sleep, some of the researchers who are doing this say, yeah, this is just, you know, sort of a video replay. They're just reenacting the stuff that they did in their lives. There's no creative force going on here. No imagination, no alternate reality going on in here. You don't buy that, though.
I don't. And I think this is maybe a vestige of what I mentioned earlier as the legacy of behaviorism, because I think a lot of scientists are still a little bit suspicious about the mental capacities of other animals. And so sometimes they just find it easier in the moment to say, I don't know that I want to call this, let's say, dreaming or thinking or emotion or imagination in the case of a non-human animal, because then that does introduce the burden and the challenge of trying to figure out what that means in the case of a non-human, which is not easy. I mean, I specialize in animal philosophy and animal science, and yes, it's fascinating, but it's also very tricky because you have to walk some uneven terrains sometimes. And so I disagree with people who believe that animals don't dream, or that if they have some experiences, then they must be so inferior to ours that they don't deserve the name dreaming. And I think the evidence actually is on my side in this debate. I think by now the preponderance of the evidence indicates that animals do dream, and that includes not only mammals, but it includes also birds. It includes, I just mentioned insects and arthropods. In the book, I also talk about cephalopods like octopuses, which are just so distant from us from an evolutionary point of view that it raises questions about the origin of dreaming. How far back in the history of life do we have to go to find, you know, the first dream or the first dreamer? And it just boggles the mind in many ways.
Talking to David Peña Guzman, author of the new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. David, what to you is the best study, the best research you've seen that's a selling point to make the case that, yes, in fact, animals are dreaming in a meaningful way, not just arbitrarily replaying the events of the day?
Well, I think we live in a culture where neuroscience has a lot of cultural capital. I think in the last 40 years or so, it really has become the lingua franca of science, especially when it comes to animals and behavior. And so that's why I focus on a lot of neuroscientific research, looking at brain activity, patterns of neural activation in many animals. I look primarily at rodents and other mammals, just because we have a lot more research about them. But I also talk about patterns of neural activation in other species like birds and also fish. There's been some interesting research on brainwave activity during REM sleep in certain species of fish. And so I think the neuroscience is extremely persuasive when it comes to establishing these parallels between waking experience and the sleep state or the dream state. But I also think that we need to be open to the behavioral evidence, to the things that we do observe in those animals that we share our life with. I don't think it's a major jump or an unreasonable jump or a leap of faith for somebody to look at a sleeping dog or at a sleeping cat who is running and vocalizing and fighting with imaginary enemies in the middle of sleep, and to say, you know what? I think this is probably a dream. And unfortunately, that's the kind of conclusion that a lot of scientists want to resist, again, for the reasons that I talked about a little bit earlier.
Now, consciousness is one of the trickiest ideas in philosophy and neuroscience, psychology for that matter. But can you connect the dots? If we accept the argument that, yeah, animals are dreaming, what does that tell us about our search for consciousness among our fellow animals?
Yeah, I once was told by an expert that if you ask 10 people who specialize in consciousness to define consciousness, you'll get about 15 different definitions. And in some ways, the book that I wrote is entirely about this question. It is about dreaming. Of course, that's the subject of the book, but it is because I see dreaming as intricately connected to questions of sentience, to questions of consciousness, to questions of agency, and what in the book I call subjectivity. So I want to think about the subjectivity of animals by using their dreams as this entry point into their lived world. And so one way to make the connection explicit here between dreaming and consciousness is through three intermediary categories. And these are the three categories that, for example, organize my analysis in the central and most important chapter of the book, which is chapter 2. And those three categories are subjectivity, affect or emotion, and finally, metacognition. So what I do in the book is I look at research on the philosophy of dreaming and the science of dreaming. Of course, here focusing in the case of humans, just how we have thought about the significance of dreams in the course of, you know, over the last couple of millennia in philosophy and science. And I argue that there are some fundamental links that we already accept between dreaming and being consciously aware of the world, between having dreams and having emotions, and between having dreams, or rather some kinds of dreams, this is a more limited claim, and being metacognitive agents. And so in the book, what I do is I ask the question in reverse from the point of view of animals. So if we already recognize this connection between dreams and all these categories, given the fact that we now have it on pretty good authority, scientific and philosophical, that non-human animals also dream, does that mean that other animals also have these three different types of consciousness? Again, which I call subjective consciousness, affective consciousness, and metacognitive consciousness.
And David, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's David Peña Guzman, Associate Professor of Humanities at San Francisco State University. He was with us today sharing his new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, big national newspapers are doing big business while local papers are seeing buyouts, layoffs, and even shutdowns. What does that mean for the news we get in our communities? We'll take a look at the future of local news. Plus, we'll check out two efforts to make recreation accessible here in Wisconsin. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.